You're listening to The Point. Preventing underage consumption of drugs and alcohol isn't just about keeping kids safe now. Research shows that using addictive substances during adolescence wires the brain for addiction later in life. Later in the hour, we'll talk about raising healthy families and some of the factors that protect children from turning to drugs and alcohol. But first, how drug and alcohol use impacts the developing brain. We revisit a conversation with Dr. Ruth Pote. She's a family medicine practitioner in Western Massachusetts who's also board certified in addiction medicine. She's been a leader in the fight against opioid addiction with a particular emphasis on brain development and substance use. Dr. Pote, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you.
Our understanding of addiction is changing. We now know it's a chronic disease that requires ongoing treatment. Research also shows that addiction is a brain disease. Can you explain what happens in the brain when we use addictive substances and how substances such as alcohol and opioids damage the brain?
So what we know about addiction is that all addiction does start during this phase of the brain while it's actively making decisions about what synapses to keep and where to insulate pathways in the brain. So very few people ever develop an addiction after the age of 26. And it doesn't mean that people are shooting heroin when they're 11 or 12 years old, but what it means is that those brains of people struggling with addiction started with a substance during the time while the brain was developing. And if you ask somebody struggling, you say, what was your first substance? Was it alcohol, marijuana, or tobacco? They'll usually name one of them, and they'll say, I was 12, 13, or 15 when I first started my first addictive substance. So the what happens in the brain is it's actually a very complicated process, but there are times while the teenage brain is developing where it is losing 30,000 synaptic connections a second. Mm. And while this incredibly important pruning back process is happening, it's supposed to be what is happening during the teenage years, while there's a substance on board, it disrupts the messaging system, it disrupts the receptors that get laid down, and it changes the sort of effective, efficient pathways that get grooved down deeply in the brain. So specifically, dopamine gets interrupted, anandamide, which is really interrupted by marijuana, are the two receptors that are most heavily affected. So not all of us who started with a substance when we were a teenager will develop an addiction. A subset of us will. For those of us who have strong genetic risk or strong history of trauma, anxiety, or depression, we're at higher risk for it.
Mm. You just said something that I just find really amazing. If you can make it to age 26 without trying any of these addictive, you're the likelihood of you becoming addicted is very, very small.
Vanishingly small, less than 1%, maybe 2%, very, very small. And in fact, certainly by 26, that is absolutely true. But if you could convince and educate the young people in your life to delay use, I never say to my own kids or my patients I take care of, delay your use of tobacco. I say, don't ever smoke. It's mm-hmm. terrible for you. It's the number one killer in this country. But what I do say to my own kids and my patients is I say, look, you're going to drink someday. I suspect that's true. Mm-hmm. I need you to delay that as long as possible. And for those people who delay use of alcohol until after the age of 21 or 22, these are people who will never develop an addiction to alcohol. The brain is just much more developed. It's much less susceptible to the potency of alcohol, and people do better. And the people who really need to hear that message are those of us who have a family history, a mm-hmm. genetic risk of addiction,
right.
Because you can almost cancel out your genetic risk by postponing use. So the message that most of us who do this work have to teenagers is to delay their use as long as possible.
Yeah,
and it's hard when you're a teenager because you are so heavily influenced by your peers.
Right. And so we know that the three things you mentioned that predispose a person to addiction, early use is one, genetics is another, and trauma. So you're talking about the heredity of addiction. So is it like a 50-50? Do we know what that risk factor is?
Yeah, we think it is just the number that you just said. It's about 50% of all addiction is genetically defined, and it means that if you have a parent or a grandparent with a history of addiction, that you have a 50% chance of struggling with an addiction yourself. Yeah. And it's very hard to find any other disease that has that much genetic predisposition.
Right.
Some of the psychiatric illnesses, depression or ADD, may have that much, but very few other diseases. So the problem is most of our kids don't know about their genetic predisposition because mm-hmm. families don't talk about it because they feel full of shame, or they don't want to say things about the grandparents and the family, or somebody's in recovery and thinks, well, I'm in recovery now, so my kids don't need to know that because I'm good. But the mm-hmm. genetics haven't shifted, right? Genetics take a long time to shift. So I am a big advocate of parents talking to their kids about the genetic risk of addiction, and because the kids don't get to influence that. They get what they get, but they do get to influence their age, its first use. In these days, to be honest, my bigger worry is not just tobacco or alcohol, but it's really marijuana, because marijuana is the number one drug abused by teenagers around the country, and it's as high as 35% of high school seniors are using marijuana in the last month. That is, these days, a lot of people under the age of 21 or 22 will tell you this is a benign drug. No one ever gets addicted to it. It's all safe. It's all good for you. It cures all diseases. So the sense of harm with marijuana has really vanished, and instead, teenagers are using it often, not just once a week, but several times a day, and it has a big impact on how the brain develops.
I'm going to go to the marijuana question for a second. Marijuana has not been considered an addictive drug, but we have really very little research about the impacts of marijuana on the brain. So what do we know?
Well, so it is an addictive drug, but at lower rates than it is with nicotine. Nicotine is the most addictive drug out there. Sugar is really the most addictive drug out there. 95% of rats get addicted to sugar in a very short amount of time. For those of us addicted to sugar, that doesn't surprise us. Mm-hmm. The rates of addiction to tobacco are about 33%, and the rates of addiction to marijuana in an adult brain, meaning an adult who starts marijuana use, is about 9%. So when you look at the rates of addiction in a teenage brain, it's about 17 or 18%, which is still lower than nicotine. That's good, I guess. But it's right behind heroin, quite honestly, in terms of addiction rates. Most people wouldn't have said that. And the problem with all of that is that's research or demographics done on the old marijuana with the THC potency of less than 2.5%. That's what those people out there of my generation, I'm 47 years old, who've used marijuana will say, I've used it, it's fine. I tell you, today's marijuana is nothing familiar to anybody over the age of 30. Today's marijuana's potency are ranging between 9% and 16% just in the field-grown product. And then once the industry takes it and concentrates it, which is what happens all over the places that have legalized marijuana for recreational use, the potency of the THC is sitting between 40 and 90%.
Wow.
So what are the addiction rates of that marijuana? Like, what we don't know about marijuana is enormous, and what we think we know is, a lot of it is inaccurate. So the internet espouses a tremendous number of beliefs about marijuana and its safety and its healthfulness and its natural, organic nature. But I tell you, we need to be spending a huge amount of time and money to research this and understand more its impact on the developing brain and on other disease entities. And we're not ready to legalize this drug, I'll say that. But by the time this airs, I think we'll have a very clear answer on what state of Massachusetts did with ballot measure 4.
Yeah, no, we haven't done a lot of research on this, but there has been research done in other countries. So what are we gleaning from that? I think Australia has done some
research. Australia and New Zealand have done the best research. There's just some research out of Europe, but I would say Australia and New Zealand. And so the studies that the Dunedin study is the best known study, where they're following people who started marijuana use at the age of 13, 14, and 15. So sort of the normal age that kids experiment with marijuana in this country are those ages. And they follow those people over the next 25 years. And they compare them to their same cohort of people who did not use marijuana. And what it shows is in a 25-year span, there's an 8-point drop in IQ. There's a high sense of not having met my purpose in life. I'm not working the way I want to. There's far lower graduation rates from college. There's a much higher rate of unemployment under the age of 25. And the problem with all of those studies, right, saying indicating marijuana is probably not good for health and for long-term fulfilling yourself as a human being. But the problem with it is it's done on the old marijuana, right? It's done on the 2.5% THC. So do you think your IQ is getting better at 40% THC? I doubt it, right? You can't convince me that you're a better driver, that you're better at your job when you are really high on the most psychoactive component of marijuana. And again, this is for me is about following the money. The industry of marijuana needs to hook as many people as possible to make this a viable product in this country. And their business model is about addicting as many people under the age of 25 as possible. That's at least half their business model when you figure out how much it's going to cost to grow this stuff. Mm-hmm. So they're making a more potent product that's more addictive. It's just what big tobacco did in the early 1900s. And we've been through this before. Mm-hmm. I have no interest in returning to the days of everybody being a smoker like that yeah. happened in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we haven't seemingly learned that lesson is, you know, I think we can do better as a society. If I got more data, if I could convince myself that, one, this drug would not end up in the hands of people under the age of 25, truth is, I don't think it's any worse than alcohol. And if the average 32-year-old wants to go home one night and smoke some marijuana and not drive and not go to work, I don't really care. But that's not what we see. We see when this drug gets legalized, it ends up in the hands of people who are younger with a developing brain, and it's going to have a longer-term health impact on that generation of people.
Yeah, I want to go back to the alcohol for a second. You also suggest that parents pay attention to how they use substances such as alcohol around their kids. So what kind of messages can we inadvertently be sending to our teens?
I think that this is the understated drug of abuse in our society. I spend a lot of my days working with people with a heroin addiction or struggling with a pill addiction, but alcohol abuse and misuse in this country ranges between 10 and 14%. And as anybody knows who reads the newspaper, who works in the correctional criminal justice system, a huge number of people get themselves into a lot of trouble with alcohol, including alcohol on the roads. But also, just lives fall apart with alcohol misuse. Relationships fall apart. People are less good parents. And a lot of people drink because they're self-medicating. They're doing it to decrease their stress, their anxiety, to unwind at home after a hard day at work. And if what your kid sees is every day you walk into the house and you uncork a bottle of wine and you flip the top of a can of beer, and what they see is, man, I had a hard day at work, glug, glug, glug. Mm. The message is that when you're stressed out and overwhelmed, you should drink.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the message you'd love to send to your kids? Wow, I had a terrible day at work. I want to quit my job. Will somebody go for a walk with me? Mm. I'm going to go stand in the corner, and I'm going to just go get myself into yoga tree pose and meditate a little bit and calm my nervous system down. There's so many good ways of decreasing your emotions and decreasing your stress that are healthy behaviors that would be wonderful for your kids to see instead of trying to numb it up with alcohol or other drugs.
Yeah.
But that's the message most of us send. Think how often you as an adult have gone out with your girlfriends and not had a drink. Think how often your kids have attended a party where really alcohol was really the focus of the event. These are the lessons we send to our kids.
Yeah. The other thing, third thing that we mentioned that predisposes us to addiction is trauma during adolescence. So first, how do we define trauma in children? And can you explain what happens to the adolescent brain when it's exposed to trauma?
Well, so it actually is trauma anywhere under the age of 18, so it can really be a childhood trauma as well. And trauma is defined in the better studies that we watch of household dysfunction, neglect, and abuse, and that abuse can be physical, verbal, or sexual. The ACE study is the study that I cite the most often, and it talks about what happens to a child living in a home where they feel unloved, uncared for, where there's not good access to food, where they feel like they actually could be harmed verbally or physically that day or sexually, where they're worried that, you know, they're going to come home from second grade and find that their mom is overdosed in the bathroom and their parents are fighting all the time or going through a horrible divorce, where one of the parents is incarcerated or suffers with major mental illness. These are very traumatic things to happen to a child. And when a child lives in those circumstances where they don't know what is going on, when their life is so unstable and filled with such chaos, it sends them into this perpetual fight-or-flight fear response, survival mode. And, you know, we're not meant to be in survival mode, high adrenaline, coursing through our bodies, evolutionarily speaking. It happened infrequently. We got chased by a bear, our adrenaline went up, we ran like crazy, we sheltered down in a cave, and then we got better. Kids who grow up in households that are filled with dysfunction and neglect and abuse, they are trying to survive every single day, and that affects every cell in their body, every organ in their body. Those kids are at higher risk of every chronic disease out there, including dying earlier by 5 years, heart attacks, emphysema, broken bones, more sexual partners. And specifically, growing up in a household with that level of neglect sets you up for the disease of addiction and the disease of chronic pain.
Mm.
And as a public health entity, if one could decrease disease rates over time, it would be about decreasing the amount of trauma our kids face, helping kids, you know, relocate or helping them get the trauma support they need. And so there's no better way to numb up your psychologic pain than to drink too much or to drug, because it makes you numb to all emotion.
Right. So we know that the developing brain is more susceptible to addiction, but does it work the other way as well? Is the developing brain better to able recover from the damage caused by drugs?
Wow, that's a great question, too. What I'll say is that the less time you've been addicted, the easier it is to get your treatment success. So I'm one of these moms who has a full belief that any one of my kids could develop an addiction. I'm not one of these people who thinks I'm above it or I'm going to prevent it because I know more. I look at my kids and I worry about them. I worry about them driving. I worry about them getting a concussion, and I worry about them developing an addiction. I want to be the kind of mom who figures out that my kid is struggling with an addiction about 3 months in. Earlier if possible. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be the mom who figured it out 3 years in, because the difference between helping a person at 3 years of engagement in a major substance use problem at 3 months is a lot easier than at 3 years. The brain changes are a lot deeper. The grooves are a lot deeper. So there are a lot of people who would argue that addiction for many of us is almost a learning disorder, and that by the age of 24, some people have really almost grown out of it. And there's a big difference when somebody walks into my office needing help with addiction at the age of 17. I look at them and think, wow, I'm going to have a hard time capturing you. Impulse control is poor. The brain is still actively developing. The prefrontal cortex and the part of the brain that makes slow, reasoned decisions is not yet in place. And by 23 or 24, I'm dealing with a brain that's much more mature, where decisions are more reasonable, where there's a more slowed thinking process in a positive way. And I have more success helping those people. So treatment is actually harder as in an adolescent, but there is good recovery. I'm a big believer that people get better with addiction, and it takes time. These days of 5 or 7 day detoxes and kick you to the curb and you're all better, that doesn't work, right? Yeah. What helps with addiction is what you said early on, which is that this is a chronic disease that needs lifelong treatment, much the way that we think of people who struggle with diabetes or obesity or, you know, uncontrolled hypertension. Those aren't diseases that magically go away one day and you never need to pay attention to them. Most people with diabetes exercise and eat well and try to make better health style choices, and they take medicines that make them better. But they do it for a lifetime.
So
you've got to think about disease the same way.
Yeah, I'm thinking of infants who are born addicted. You know, their mothers may have been using while they were pregnant. Do we know much about how infants recover from this? Does this impact them as much as it would older kids? You know, I'm thinking they're so young. Are they developing enough there that they recover quickly?
So at this point, we have probably 20-something years of data on babies who are exposed to opiates in utero and then have followed them. So this work often has been done actually in Boston right down the street from us. And those babies do great, quite honestly. You know, there was in the 1980s a huge amount of time was spent on the crack babies. Mm-hmm. Babies exposed to cocaine in utero were fine for the most part. They didn't exhibit major developmental problems. They were a little smaller than normal, but that was it. The most harmful drugs in pregnancy are cigarettes and alcohol. Alcohol by far. And fetal alcohol syndrome has a huge impact on the development of the brain and in terms of learning disability. So if you get enough services, and in general, the rules regarding kids, infants exposed in utero, is you've got to get them a lot of services early to make sure that they have as many learning opportunities as possible. But in general, in utero, babies do pretty darn well, and moms engaged in treatment are moms who are trying to get better. So I love it when moms who are pregnant come in or can acknowledge that they're struggling with something and that our job is to help them get better, get them back to stable lives so that they can create healthy home environments for their kids.
Yeah. Finding out your teenager is using opioids is every parent's nightmare. And with the opioid epidemic that we're experiencing now, you're really in fear of this. So what are some of the early warning signs that could indicate drug use? You mentioned if you could get your child early into that pattern, 3 months maybe is a lot better than if it's 3 years down the line. So what are some of the signs we're looking for?
So some of the signs I think I would pay attention to is, you know, I think I'm a parent of teenagers. I see it every day. And there's a lot of moodiness that happens in the house full of teenagers, right? There's people who are irritable and fast-moving moods, both high joy and then high crabbiness. And that can be a very normal teenage brain, but there's a lot of our teenage brains that are slightly anxious or really anxious or depressed, and paying attention to your kids' mood and not just dismissing it, and offering them and getting them the therapies that help them, whether it's a lot of physical exercise, going to yoga or meditating, actually having a really good therapist who gets your kid. If you have a kid who has major mental illness, you need to get them treatment, because what teenagers might do is self-medicate with marijuana or alcohol or heroin or opiates just to feel better than they're currently feeling. So that's one of the early things, is to pay attention to how your kid's mental health is and get them the need, what they need for that. And then the second thing is, when your kid really looks like they're starting to fail early on, they're no longer interacting with their friends and their cohort, they're not doing as well in school, I pay attention to my kids' bedrooms and their book bags. I look for stuff that are warning signs. If I ever found a pill in my kid's room, that for me is a major red flag. Mm-hmm. Any instruments you would use to use any drugs, a straw to snort through, a needle to inject with, something that you would use as a tourniquet, any burnt foil, burnt gum wrappers. There should never be burnt foil in your house. I can't imagine a situation where you would have that. Mm-hmm. That was in your kid's room. That is a major red flag that they are actually cooking drugs in their room and using it. So I don't clean my kids' bedrooms. I don't do their laundry, but I do a walkthrough on a fairly regular basis to make sure that there's stuff in there that shouldn't be in there. I want to get rid of it. Yeah. So during one of my talks, I spend time talking about what other parents have found in their kids' rooms when they realized they were struggling with an opiate use disorder.
We talk a lot about drug use prevention, education, and messaging. How can we better tailor that messaging and information to adolescents, since we know that that the knowledge of the risks doesn't always prevent them from engaging in risky behavior?
No, I think that's a great question. I do think the Just Say No campaign didn't really work, and I think most people would agree with that one. I think acknowledging that most teenagers actually don't use drugs, like 70%, 75% aren't using alcohol, or even more than that, aren't using cigarettes. We have the lowest rates of tobacco use that we've ever seen in history. So I am a big believer that knowledge is power, and that our kids do better when they have good knowledge about things. And I have found it quite effective to talk about the impact that your behaviors now have on your developing brain. So I think parents talking about this stuff, talking about delaying use to delay the risk of exposure, particularly in high-risk individuals, and talk about the fact that, look, my friend, I want you to be a person who gets to do exactly what you want. I want you to have a great career and a great family if that's what you want. I want you to climb Mount Everest if that's what you want. But you need to walk into your young adulthood with a brain that is making good decisions and has not walked down the path of bad decisions. And this is the major way that you can influence this, is to stay away from addictive substances.
Dr. Ruth Pody will be the keynote speaker at Falmouth Cares, a community forum on addiction and the adolescent brain, Sunday, April 8th at noon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to seeing people on that Sunday. Thank you.
Coming up after a break, how we keep teens safer, healthier, and substance-free in middle and high school. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about substance abuse prevention in children and teens. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joining us now in studio is Kim Slade. She's a program specialist with the Substance Abuse Prevention Collaborative at the Barnstable County Department of Human Services. Welcome, Kim.
Hi, thank you for having us.
And Laura Fenton, who is the school adjustment counselor at Falmouth High School. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having us.
So before the break, we mentioned the community forum on addiction and the adolescent brain that's coming up on Sunday. Tell us about the forum and the goals.
The ideas really came out of what we've been seeing in the schools and around the community. This is the second year that Falmouth has sponsored a conference on addiction. And we thoughtfully got together and created some breakout sessions based on the feedback that we were getting from parents and community. We have some really great breakout sessions to be able to educate the community around issues that we know that they're facing around vaping, legalization of marijuana, and just parenting in this day and age. So we're really excited to have our guest speaker, Dr. Pote, who we just heard from, join us this year as well.
Yeah. You want to add anything to that, Kim? No, okay. So, Laura, are you hoping teens are going to come to the forum too, or is this geared primarily toward adults? Who is it focused?
We developed the conference really to gear it towards the adults. However, we've had some really great publicity. So we do have a teen group. We've added a fifth breakout session to include some teens from Bourne's Purple Project and also from Falmouth's Jack's Pact. Mm-hmm. And they will be talking with their peers around ways that they can be teenagers in this day and age and choose not to use substances. Yeah, so we're really excited to have that fifth breakout session for
them. So these
them.
Two groups that you're talking about, these are groups of kids who have made this decision not to use drugs and alcohol.
Yes.
Right. So, and we're seeing more of those, aren't we, in the schools?
Yes. Yeah. We definitely are.
Yeah. All right. So the science on how drug use impacts the developing brain is compelling and good information for teens to have. What's your advice for talking with teens about substance use?
And so when it comes to talking to teens about substance use, the number one thing that you need to remember is to not talk with them when they've been using. Mm-hmm. Get them in a situation where there's no distractions around them. Sit down with them. Talk with them. Be prepared to talk about potentially your own past substance use. That's for each individual parent to decide. But just be open with them, honest with them. You don't want to use scare tactics. They don't work. Mm-hmm. And we've found that the more parents talk to their kids about it and express their desire for their teen not to use, there's a lot of influence there from our parents, and teens are less likely to use.
Yeah. Before we went on, you were mentioning that in surveys and things with the teenagers, sometimes it was a pretty high percentage who said, my parents never told me not to.
Right. So what we found with our student surveys here on Cape Cod is that we do have students who do use marijuana, but out of those students, 50% of them don't think that their parents think there's anything wrong with using marijuana and are three times more likely to use. So it becomes really important for parents to set those boundaries and tell their kids that we don't want you using, even if they do use mm-hmm. Themselves. So out of the parents who use marijuana, about 80% of them don't approve of their kids using marijuana or other adults using marijuana around their kids.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned talking to your kids, talk to them when they're not using. If you have a child who maybe has not tried that yet, what's your thought on how you talk to those kids?
Educate them. Know the facts. And like I said a few minutes ago, don't use scare tactics. They don't work. Education really is key. We're finding kids shy away when you do use scare tactics. It kind of lessens the credibility of what parents are saying versus giving them straight facts and information that they can look at and see. And also learning what your kid is hearing and being exposed to and knowing where they are and using that information to sit down and really lay out a plan with them of what they can do if they're ever in a situation that they don't know how to get out of.
There's a good chance that your child has already had a conversation or already has some knowledge about drugs and alcohol just based on the music that they're listening mm-hmm. to, the movies that they're seeing, and then conversations they may already be having in school, either with their peers or sometimes even with their teachers. So a good question to start with, you know, is what do you know? Mm-hmm. And do you have any questions? I always tell my kids, and I'm sure they're laughing if they're listening, I want you to ask me mm-hmm. so that I can be the one to give you that answer. I'd rather it come from your parents than from one of your peers who may not have the right answer for you.
I say over the years, there have been drug prevention programs and anti-drug messaging aimed at adolescents for decades. So, you know, just say no and all these different approaches. There was the DARE program. So what do we know about what works and what approaches don't?
So what we found out about the DARE program from back in the 80s and 90s is that it doesn't work. If anything, they were showing that more kids were picking up and using different substances. For prevention programs now that we use in schools and out in the community, we're using that opportunity not just to educate kids on the dangers of different substances, but also to build up the positive coping skills that they have for any kind of life situation. So learning these skills on, you know, taking a break or taking a walk, meditation, just how to deal with emotions, anxiety, stress is really a key component in building up the resiliency in our kids and giving them that information that they need to stay away from substance use.
Hmm. Laura, you mentioned vaping. E-cigarettes and vaping have become popular in the last few years. Can you, for those who are going, what is that? Can you explain what that is? And do we have data on the numbers of teens engaging with these activities that might lead to substance abuse down the road?
So you've probably seen people vaping in the community. You just don't know that they're doing it. Now that I know what it is, I see it more and more often. If I'm waiting in the line at a drive-thru and someone leaves the restaurant to go throw out the trash, it looks like they're just carrying a pen, but the pen goes to their mouth and there's suddenly a cloud of smoke. I've seen this over and over again when I'm out in the community in a restaurant or grabbing a coffee somewhere, and it looks really innocent, but because you don't know what it is. We actually have a breakout session where one of our community resource people is going to be speaking about this, and we'll have some examples of e-cigarettes, Juuls, to show people, you know, what they look like and how they work and what kids are putting in them. What we're seeing more and more of an increase of that, even in the schools, unfortunately.
Yeah. You want to add something, Kim?
Absolutely. So, unfortunately, what we're seeing is that e-cigarettes and vaping are the most widely used form of any kind of nicotine delivery device when it comes to our youth. The CDC just recently released an infographic that has amazing information on the dangers of vaping, and we do know that it's not safe for youth use. The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine recently released a report as well that said that e-cigarettes do have the potential to benefit adult smokers who are not pregnant when they're used as a complete substitute for traditional cigarettes, but youth who use vapes and e-cigarettes are actually shown to be more likely to begin using traditional cigarettes. Mm. We also know that they can be used to deliver marijuana, and that's something that we're seeing more in the schools are these cigarettes or these vapes and e-cigarettes are being modified to use marijuana in the schools because of the lack of smell. We do know that there are aerosols used in vapes and e-cigarettes that can contain harmful substances like heavy metals and cancer causing agents, and while reports have shown that it's supposedly less harmful than traditional cigarettes, we really don't know the long-term effects. Mm. So it's really important for parents to educate themselves on those facts, because kids do think that it's harmless or that it's got lower risk, when in reality it puts kids at greater risk of using additional tobacco products.
Yeah. Heroin addiction is a public health epidemic, as we know, and understandably parents are worried about their children using heroin, and that might make them less concerned if their child is drinking or smoking pot. There are some who think of that as sort of a rite of passage. So what are your thoughts on that?
Not just around alcohol, but any substance. What we know is that any substance used by a teen can lead to drug use. It changes the neural pathways in the brain during a time of critical brain development. And when we're looking at the different substances, we really need to be addressing the risk factors and the gateway behaviors rather than specific drugs. The three most commonly used substances prior to the age or before the age of 15 are tobacco products, marijuana, and alcohol, which can lead to additional substance use. And the really important thing there is to be aware of what your kids are doing and delay the onset of drug use if abstinence isn't possible.
Mm-hmm. So there are certain factors that can protect teens from engaging in risking behaviors like drug and alcohol use. What are examples of protective factors?
Parents are the single most important influence on a child's decision to engage in this kind of behavior. Any kind of positive adult relationship, a teacher, a coach, a youth pastor, somebody in the community or within their schools or other activities that they're involved in who has a positive relationship on them can be a protective factor. Educating, as Kim said, educating your child, having those conversations with your child, being the one that opens the door to say, it's okay to talk to me about this. And if you have questions, I might not have the answer, but we can figure it out together. Parenting practices, you know, have a conversation, not a confrontation. Listen non-judgmentally. I know it's hard. I've been there. But do your best to try to listen non-judgmentally, because they have these questions. And if they don't come to you for the answers, they may get the wrong answer somewhere else. And positive coping skills. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about your own, as an adult, your own use with alcohol, tobacco, and substances. If you know that you come home from work and your routine is to say, oh, I've had such a rough day, I'm going to pour myself a glass of wine, you're modeling that for your child. And what is your child seeing when they see you do this? You might even ask them, how does that affect you when you see me have a cigarette or when you see me have a drink? How does that affect you? What is your interpretation of that? Let's talk about it. These are not easy conversations.
Yeah.
They're difficult.
Well, that was going to be my next thing. There's sometimes, sometimes a parent and a child have that kind of tension, and A, this parent may try to talk to the, and the child's like, I don't want to hear it from you. Mm-hmm. So if you're in that kind of a situation where you find it difficult yourself, or you have a child who maybe is tuning you out, Who would be the best to have that conversation with them if it can't be the parents?
I'd say to be prepared that you are going to get called out on your own behaviors. if you're going to be having a difficult conversation with them that makes them feel awkward, they're definitely going to throw it back on you. That's just part of being a teenager. But you might ask for somebody to help you and be a reinforcement, a grandparent, a partner, a favorite auntie, you know, one of those other positive adult people in your child's life that could have a conversation with your child, so that it might be the buffer. You know, if you start to feel your blood boiling, you can look to your to your friend, the other positive adult person, and they can take over while you take a deep breath and do some mindful meditation and calm down.
I just said being calm. Yeah, we heard that in the first segment. Danette sent us an email. She says, please send a link to this morning's show as well as info on April 8th conference. I could not find it online because it's not up there yet. We're not done with the show, but we will have the details to the April 8th forum on addiction and adolescence, including registration information at our website, capeandislands.org. We'll have a link to all three of our segments this morning. Any last final thoughts?
It is currently on many sites on Facebook. The Falmouth Police Department did share it last week. So if you look on their Facebook page and scroll down a bit, you might be able to find the link if you need it immediately, but it will be up there shortly.
Yeah, we'll get it up there. All right. Laura Fenton and Kim Slade, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the conference.
Thank you for having us.
Hope to see you next week. Thanks for having us.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.